on how to run the body scanners, which are called AITs. We're trained in detection of, people acting suspiciously and stuff like that. And so we're trained in pat downs. So all those different things, you have to be recertified on every year. We have a rigorous training program. Like I said, we have training instructors that are constantly watching us to make sure that we're constantly up to date on all of our stuff. And so, as the union, we don't think any person should come in untrained. And so anyone who is going to be helping us in those positions should be trained to the same standards as TSA officers.
I wanted to ask you also, back a year ago, March of 2025, the former Homeland Security Secretary, Kristi Noem, she basically terminated the collective bargaining rights of the 50,000 TSA agents. Could you talk about how this was actually part of the that notorious Project 2025 and this long-term strategy of the Republicans?
Yeah, absolutely. Project 2025, their intended goal for the TSA is step one, get rid of the union. Step two, privatize the TSA. And they cannot privatize the TSA without getting rid of us. And so if they can get rid of us, which they're trying to in court and we're fighting back on it, then they can privatize TSA and then their millionaire buddies can make more money by having contracts and everything like that, which would lead to not better security, not better screening for anyone, but just more possibilities for gaps in the system that terrorists can get through.
We want to thank you so much for being with us, Cameron Cochems, Vice President of AFGE, that's American Federation of Government Employees, TSA Local 1127, union representing over 4,000 workers, lead TSA officer in Boise, Idaho. Thanks, Cameron. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Currently accepting applications for our development associate position. Learn more at democracynow.org. Juan, it's been wonderful doing the show with you here in New York. Can't wait to have you back Friday.
Yeah.
I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from Clinton Street Theater, a movie theater and community space in Southeast Portland presenting independent films, live music, theater productions, and more. Information about current screenings is available at cstpdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon leaders and environmental advocates hatch an elegant solution to clean up the Portland Harbor Superfund site. A new study says the Pacific Northwest needs better planning for heat waves. And in national news, ICE agents are assigned to work airport security without their masks. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 24, 2026. I'm Eric Leuschner. Cleaning up the Portland Harbor Superfund site could have a, quote, elegant solution, according to state leaders and environmental advocates. Reporting from Oregon Journalism Project shows a plan to move contaminated sediment from the Portland Harbor to fill in the 140-foot deep Ross Island Lagoon that would save significant money. There are 150 parties that are responsible for cleaning up the Willamette River through Portland, including local and state government and the public utilities. Previous plans would have the groups dig up contaminated sediment from the riverbed and send it to landfills in central Oregon. That plan could cost $4 to $7 billion, much of it footed by taxpayers. Moving upriver would be cheaper and faster to complete. The middle of Ross Island was mined for gravel, and while that industry is stopped nowadays, the deep lagoon has major impacts. In recent years, it's been the site of toxic algae blooms that grow in the warm, stagnant water, then infect large stretches of the river, making dogs and people who use the river sick. Ross Island is owned by the embattled Pamplin Company, which has been behind on its commitments to restore Ross Island to a natural space and to city ownership. The sediment fill-in for Ross Island would only include the non-hazardous sediments, about 97% of what has to be moved. It would then be capped, meaning the sediments can't escape later on. That same capping method has been used successfully in other places, like Tacoma and New York City. In January, 10 environmental groups wrote to Governor Tina Kotek, pressing her to move forward with the idea. Last week, Kotek responded, saying state agencies will get involved with the newly proposed solution. A study from the Northwest Climate Adaptation Science Center says state and local officials in the Pacific Northwest could benefit from better planning responses to climate change-driven heat waves. A 2021 heat wave did almost $9 billion in damages and left hundreds of people dead. Mark Richardson reports.
A new study suggests that state and local officials in Washington and its Pacific Northwest neighbors could do more to plan and coordinate their responses to major heat waves driven by climate change. The report from the Northwest Climate Adaptation Science Center convened dozens of researchers and practitioners to analyze responses to the record-breaking 2021 heat wave that hit the Northwest hard. The study's lead author, University of Washington researcher Eva Kohlberg, says the extreme heat caught many off guard.
This was completely unprecedented. It broke records across the Northwest. We see a lot of folks talking about the impacts to people, but we also wanted to look into what were the ecological impact, so how are plants and animals.
Kohlberg says the June 2021 event brought temperatures of 110 degrees or more and caused $9 billion in damages. The National Weather Service estimates the heat wave caused more than 200 deaths in Washington and Oregon. Kohlberg hopes the study will help agencies better prepare for the next climate-driven heat event. Kohlberg says the study found many towns and cities did not have sufficient facilities to protect people in a region where air conditioning isn't common. She also points to major environmental damage, including killing about 1 billion shellfish and causing extreme damage to conifer forests in the region. She says it's more proof that officials need to take every opportunity to do more planning.
An example of multiple organizations and agencies working together to share their information, work and efforts and data to overcome some of those individual organization-specific limitations.
The heat also caused roads and sidewalks to buckle, melted power lines, and forced the suspension of light rail and commuter train services. It also caused the strongest melting episode for Washington glaciers in 100 years, with Mount Rainier's snowcap shrinking by an estimated 30%. Washington News Service, I'm Mark Richardson.
Funding for the Department of Homeland Security is held up in Congress over a fight for accountability and transparency measures for ICE officers, namely getting the officers to show their faces during operations. Multiple states, including Oregon and Washington, have passed mask bans to force federal agents to take off masks while on the job. Now that Trump has ordered ICE agents to work at the nation's airports, he says they can do so without masks. TSA agents are working without pay, and more workers are calling in sick in order to find paying work to support themselves. Trump volunteered armed ICE agents to alleviate long lines at some of the nation's airports. The move alarmed many Americans who are worried ICE would use overly aggressive tactics at airports. Other law enforcement officers in the United States rarely hide their identities and are virtually never allowed to remain anonymous for public accountability reasons. Trump said, quote, "I'm a big believer that they should be able to wear masks when they go and hunt down murderers, criminals, and others. But for the purposes of airports, I've requested that they take off the masks, and I believe they are willing to do that." End quote. Department of Homeland Security officials say officers have faced threats as they carry out Trump's deportation agenda, so they need masks to stay safe. Some news coverage of the ICE airport deployments showed officers running away from journalists. In one case, an ICE agent allegedly tried to use a flashlight to blind news cameras. Other instances showed ICE officers seemingly just standing around and not actively assisting in any security screenings. Representative Benny Thompson, top Democrat and former chair of the Homeland Security Committee, said, quote, "Nothing about Trump sending ICE to airports makes sense. But Trump having ICE suddenly work in public without masks proves once and for all that the masks were never about officer safety, just intimidation." End quote. The next time you drive by a home fitted with solar power technology, it might not be on the roof. Some states are considering new standards for smaller plug-in devices known as balcony solar as demand picks up. Mike Moen has the details in Minnesota.
The idea of making solar part of your home's power source mix is to keep your rising electricity bill in check. But analysts say upfront costs complicate that planning, and Minnesota wants to be part of an emerging market that features less expensive plug-in models. These units, also known as balcony solar, typically cost several hundred dollars. Traditional rooftop solar panels have long enjoyed tax credits, but still come with price tags well into the thousands. Will Mulhern with the regional nonprofit Fresh Energy says balcony solar setups are much smaller and can be easily transported, allowing more renters to adopt this technology.
So when you think about rooftop solar, a lot of folks will generate electricity and then they'll sell that back to the power grid. But with balcony solar, it's really just going to serve the devices that are in your home.
Meaning appliances and digital devices will directly soak up the captured solar power flowing into a wall outlet. Backers say this helps ease pressure on the power grid as electricity demand soars. Fresh Energy supports a legislative plan to set standards for balcony solar in Minnesota, including safety and assurances customers wouldn't have to contract with a utility like they do with rooftop connections. Utilities in other states oppose these moves, arguing unused electricity could flow back to the grid, overwhelming the system. But supporters counter that electricity generated from plug-ins is minimal compared to rooftop panels, and that product certifications from a nationally recognized testing lab can help prevent backflow. Cora Stryker is with the national nonprofit Brightsaver, which helps expand access to balcony solar. Following massive popularity in Europe, she says nearly 30 other U.S. states are considering bills similar to Minnesota's. Stryker says consumers are making it clear they don't want to be left on the sidelines in the clean energy transition.
Solar is the cheapest energy on the planet, full stop. We need all forms of it everywhere all at once. We are not in a position where we can wait any longer to reduce ordinary folks' utility bills.
Some GOP lawmakers in Minnesota have concerns about the balcony solar bill, but nationally, Stryker says there's bipartisan support for cementing a regulatory framework. That includes the Republican-controlled legislature in Utah, which passed the nation's first plug-in law. Finding savings for consumers comes as monthly electricity bills keep climbing, with an average increase of 6.7% last year. This is Mike Moen for Minnesota News Connection.
Democrats condemn ICE deployment to airports. SCOTUS hears a case challenging late-arriving mail-in ballots. And President Trump says some strikes on Iran are paused for negotiations, although Tehran says there are no direct talks. With that story and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2026 Talks.
Welcome to 2026 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
He's taking that agency that is reckless and out of control and bringing them to our airports under the lie that somehow this is going to help deal with the long lines that he created in the first place.
New Jersey Democratic Senator Cory Booker condemns President Donald Trump's deployment of ICE agents to airports. They're covering for a growing shortage in TSA staffing since Homeland Security funding lapsed in mid-February. More than 10% of security agents resigned, with more calling out sick. Trump says ICE will conduct arrests at airports, though he says they're mostly there for, quote, crowd control. Closed-door DHS budget negotiations between Democrats and Republicans haven't produced any public progress, apparently still deadlocked over reforms to ICE policing, demanded after protesters were killed in Minneapolis. Longtime TSA agent Brad Neal says the third government shutdown in 6 months is having collateral damage on other DHS staff.
This is probably the worst it's ever been, in my opinion, because of how expensive everything has gotten, and having three shutdowns back-to-back-to-back does not help.
Trump now says he won't consider a deal unless the Senate passes the Save America Act, a strict nationwide voter ID bill. Despite a marathon debate, Senate Majority Leader John Thune has said it doesn't have the backing to pass in spite of public support for voter ID.
We think they're supported by an overwhelming majority of Americans. And in many cases, as Senator Husted also pointed out, 36 states that have adopted photo ID laws. Why wouldn't we have a nationwide one?
Polls show most Americans do support voter ID laws, but the specific rules in the act are resoundingly unpopular. Senate Democrats and a few Republicans, like Alaska's Lisa Murkowski, say the SAVE Act would make it far too hard to vote, and some call it voter suppression. The Supreme Court could also make voting more difficult. The court is considering a Mississippi law that argues federal rules designating a single election day disqualify mail-in ballots received after polls close. Mississippi Solicitor General Scott Stewart says the court's decision could revert practices to those of the 19th century.
If election day must be what it was in 1845, that takes out much more than the ballot receipt laws of 30 states today. It dooms absentee voting, modern methods of voting, the secret ballot, and more. Congress did not adopt that destabilizing view when it simply set the election. election day.
As the Iran war enters its fourth week, Trump says the U.S. is holding off on attacking the country's power supply. The president says he's giving time for negotiations on Iran's nuclear program and reopening the Strait of Hormuz, although Tehran denies that there are any direct talks. Despite rising gas prices, Trump says the U.S. is negotiating from a position of strength.
Don't forget, we've wiped out the leadership phase one, phase two, and largely phase three, but we're dealing with the man who I believe is the most respected and the leader.
The Navy is redeploying an aircraft carrier group away from the region, suggesting the conflict may be winding down or entering a new phase. Though the war is sharply unpopular with Americans, Trump says the U.S. is doing, quote, extremely well there. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the revised food pyramid, healthy or harmful. At 6 o'clock, it's This Way Out. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 47 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy with a daytime high of 53 degrees. Today in history, in 2018, students across the United States staged the March for Our Lives, demanding gun control after the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School shooting. The quote of the day is from British-American political theorist Thomas Paine, who said, quote, "It is error only and not truth that shrinks from inquiry." A missing Alaska Native teen was remembered at a March Madness game in Anchorage, Alaska. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Kelly Hunt was just 19 when she went missing from Shaktulik, a small community near Nome, Alaska. The loss was felt hundreds of miles away in Anchorage, where March Madness brought basketball teams together from across the state. As KMBA's Jill Freitas tells us, a group of high school players made sure her name is not forgotten.
The stands were full, the energy was high, and on the court, the Shaktulik Wolverines were in the spotlight. Then, for a moment, the game pauses, and the focus shifts far beyond basketball. All at once, dozens of people stand and raise posters that read, "Bring Kelly home." Alexis Savage had no idea what would happen next.
Everyone came with so much passion, and you could feel it in the arena. I just wanted it to feel like if she was right there, she could feel everybody fighting for her, and that's really what it was.
What many don't know is that Kelly Hunt played on the same basketball court just a year ago as a senior in high school. She played number 15 for the Wolverines. Savage says moments like this matter because awareness for missing people like Kelly needs to be sustained to make a difference, especially in Alaska, where cases involving Alaska Natives don't often get the attention they deserve. Savage is from Buckland, a close-knit Inupiaq community not unlike Shaktulik. She says Kelly's disappearance hits close to home.
I had a loved one from my hometown go missing a few years back, and I just felt like there wasn't very much action taken. And that was the start of my advocacy, where I just felt the need to speak up for people that just can't speak for themselves.
Savage has children of her own and says stories like Kelly's are a reminder of why it's so important to keep speaking up, to keep sharing names and faces, and to never let cases like Kelly's fade from public view. In Anchorage, I'm Jill Freitas.
Oak Flat is no longer part of the Tonto National Forest in Arizona following a recent land exchange. The 2,400 acres just east of Phoenix, long considered Apache Holy Land, is now private property belonging to a multinational mining company. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has more on what's next.
Despite new ownership, Resolution Copper president Vicky Pesce stresses
Oak Flat will remain mostly untouched.
We wanted to make sure that the look, the feel of the area was very similar to how the Forest Service had managed it.
Minus a massive 2-mile-wide crater expected to swallow Oak Flat within the next 4 or so decades. In the meantime, they hired Four Winds Contracting to maintain it.
All their employees are from San Carlos, so they will be out there to manage the campground, to make sure they keep it clean and orderly and neat.
A new website is letting larger groups apply for special use permits.
If people want to come and use the campground, it is open. If people want to use it for cultural purposes, absolutely welcome to do so, and we're excited to work with everybody.
Even Apache Stronghold, the nonprofit, fought the copper mine all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. A spiritual gathering is planned there this weekend, a first since a panel of federal judges allowed the congressional land exchange to go through. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Credit card debt in Oregon has increased substantially over the past 3 years, with balances rising by more than 25% since the pandemic. Oregonians now carry an average of $6,200 in credit card debt at interest rates topping 22% or more. Consumer advocates say lawmakers have failed to act to lower rates. Mark Richardson reports.
Consumer advocates say price increases and high interest rates have many Americans, including Oregonians, drowning in debt, and lawmakers have failed to protect them. A new analysis of credit card holders finds that 40% of U.S. adults can't pay off their credit card balances monthly, with interest rates nearly double that of a decade ago. Jennifer Zhang, a data analyst with the nonprofit Protect Borrowers, says the cost of borrowing just keeps rising.
Americans owe more credit card debt than at any point in history, and they are facing sky-high interest rates, which are nearly double the rates charged just a decade ago. They're over 22% today.
In Oregon, average credit card balances are more than $6,200 per household, which is slightly below the national average, reflects a 25% increase since 2021. Zhang blames a large part of the problem on the so-called Trump economy, with high tariffs on imported goods and steep increases in the cost of gasoline and other sources of energy. Zhang says that increase is mostly due to the cost of living increases. She says the Trump administration once proposed lower interest rates, but instead made deep cuts to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
A little over 2 months ago, the president promised to cap credit card interest rates at 10% by January 20th, and we've seen that that date has come and gone, and there has been no real plan to make that promise a reality.
She says each day without an interest rate cap costs Americans an estimated $368 million in additional interest. Zhang says the poor economy is often a compounding factor when cardholders fall behind.
Oftentimes when people are late on a credit card, it's because something else has gone catastrophically wrong. If they lost a job, if they had a large medical bill or some other surprise expense, all of those costs can really rapidly pile up, and the interest only makes it substantially worse.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Mark Richardson.
Retiring farmers are finding a new way to pass on their land. A national nonprofit helps transfer farmland into community ownership and ensures it will be managed sustainably. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Farmers often spend decades caring for their land. And when they retire, many hope to pass it on to others who will farm in an environmentally responsible way. Some are even willing to donate part or all of their land, or sell it at a discount, to keep it in good hands.
It's not just the land that they're protecting, they're also trying to pass on this legacy of a farm that they've built.
Christina Villa is co-founder of the Farmers Land Trust, a national nonprofit. Her group helps landowners transfer their land into communal nonprofit ownership. The land is then leased at affordable, long-term rates to new farmers who might otherwise struggle to buy land.
We see that helping that aging, retiring population to find a new way and model to transition their farmland will actually help improve land access for young and beginning farmers.
The new farmers pledge to use organic, regenerative farming methods, like planting cover crops and applying compost. This improves soil health without using fossil fuel-based fertilizers that cause climate pollution, and it can reduce erosion and runoff during extreme storms. So Villa says the model protects climate-resilient farmland and helps new farmers afford land. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
President Trump has said he can do, quote, anything I want with Cuba. He has made clear that he wants nothing less than the dismantling of Cuba's political economy. Cuba vows resistance, but the U.S. energy blockade has put the island's economy and its people in a humanitarian crisis. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Regime change in Cuba may be the next stop for the Trump war machine. Here's what he told CNN in an interview March 6. Quote, Cuba is gonna fall pretty soon. They want to make a deal, and so I'm going to put Marco, meaning Rubio, over there, and we'll see how that works out. We're really focused on this one, meaning the Iran war, right now. We've got plenty of time, but Cuba's ready. I've been watching it for 50 years, and it's fallen right into my lap because of me. It's fallen, but it's nevertheless fallen right into the lap, and we're going to do very well. The Justice Department followed up by indicting several Cuban officials and entities for their alleged involvement in drug trafficking, a tactic now also being used to pursue another Trump critic, Colombia's President Gustavo Petro. The authority for Trump's threats to Cuba are contained in an executive order on January 29th. It states that, quote, the policies, practices, and actions of the government of Cuba constitute an unusual and extraordinary threat to U.S. national security and foreign policy. The executive order declared a national emergency under the National Emergency Act and invoked the International Emergency Economic Powers Act of 1977. That law gives Trump the power to impose tariffs on foreign countries that directly or indirectly supply oil to the Cuban government. To be clear, there is no national emergency, nor is there evidence that Cuba constitutes a threat of any kind to U.S. national security, no more so than Iran or Venezuela. The real emergency is humanitarian, the needless suffering being imposed on the Cuban people by a U.S. economic embargo that denies necessities to the population, such as food, medicine, and medical equipment. In a January 11 social media post, shortly after U.S. forces seized Venezuela's leader, Nicolas Maduro, Trump asserted that there would be, quote, no more oil or money going to Cuba. Trump is in the driver's seat here. The threat to its oil suppliers of high tariffs, accompanied by a cutoff of Venezuelan oil shipments to Cuba, has left Cuba's economy without imported oil for 3 months. Cuba relies on those shipments for about 60% of its energy. Cuba's president, Miguel Díaz-Canel, has little choice but to deal with Trump. He's now in talks with the U.S. Díaz-Canel says he is insisting that the talks must take place with mutual respect for each other's political systems, which is about the last thing Trump would agree to. He and Rubio want nothing less than a dismantling of Cuba's political economic system. Díaz-Canel seems willing to make economic changes, such as allowing exiles to invest in the island. His government has also released some political prisoners. Rubio quickly made clear that Díaz-Canel's proposals were insufficient. Cuba has an economy that doesn't work and a political and governmental system that can't fix it, said Rubio. So they have to change dramatically. What they announced is not dramatic enough. It's not going to fix it. So they've got some big decisions to make over there. What Rubio is really saying is that nothing short of regime change will satisfy the U.S. Trump has said just that. A week ago, he demanded the resignation of Díaz-Canel. Presumably, Trump will decide who should be president of Cuba. Marco Rubio would then become Cuba's viceroy, dictating policies designed to keep Cuba firmly under U.S. control. On March 18, Trump told reporters, quote, we'll be doing something with Cuba very soon. A day earlier, the president floated the idea of, quote, taking Cuba in some form, after saying last month that a friendly takeover of Cuba was possible. Whether I free it, take it, I think I could do anything I want with it, Trump told reporters. Spoken like a true imperialist. U.S. threats have led Díaz-Canel to say Cuba will resist any U.S. attempt to take over the island. In the face of the worst scenario, he said, Cuba is accompanied by a certainty. Any external aggressor will clash with an impregnable resistance. But when it comes to the capacity to resist, Cuba is far more like Venezuela than like Iran. Gone are the days when Cubans rose up against an invasion. That was in 1961, when the new Kennedy administration suffered its first major foreign policy defeat. He expected Cubans to reject Fidel Castro's revolution and welcome the overthrow of the government by Cuban exiles, who had trained in Guatemala with the full knowledge and support of the preceding Eisenhower administration. Didn't happen. The exiles' invasion was easily defeated. Fidel welcomed the Russians instead, and a year later, the U.S.-Russia missile crisis resulted. Díaz-Canel isn't Castro, and it is hard to see how a U.S. show of force could be effectively resisted when the country is on the verge of economic collapse. And this time around, Trump has plenty of support in Congress. Only the war with Iran, he says, affects the timeline for dealing with Cuba. Should Trump fail to achieve any of his objectives in Iran, as now seems likely, he may be more determined than ever to seek a win in Cuba. I'm Mel Gertow for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 24, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Mel Gertoff. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Mark Richardson, Edwin J. Vieira, Antonia Gonzalez, and Mike Moen. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth.
KBOO News in depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.